Turnover in the C-suite is at an all-time high, and in today's podcast episode, you'll hear more on the reasons for that trend. Also learn about how the skill set for today's CFO is changing. But first, take a moment to listen to a word from our sponsor.
Did you know 75% of people now prefer to pay by credit or debit? With CPA Charge, you can let your clients pay their bill online and you'll get the reporting details you need for easy reconciliation. AICPA members can sign up at cpacharge.com/podcast and get your program fee waived for 6 months.
Welcome to the Journal of Accountancy podcast. This is Senior Editor Neil Amato. Today I'm joined by Scott Simmons, the Managing Director of Crist Colder Associates in the Chicago metropolitan area. Scott leads searches for CFOs, chief operating officers, and corporate board members for clients in a variety of industries. Here's the episode with Scott Simmons. Scott, thank you for being here today.
Happy to be here, Neil.
First, tell us about what your firm, Crist Colder, does and how you got started in it.
Sure. So our firm, which we launched back in January of 2003, really was launched as a CFO boutique, a firm that does CFO search work, primarily at the beginning for public companies. Though at the beginning, there were three of us, Peter Crist, myself, and Peter's longtime assistant, Jackie Boyd. You fast forward to today, we're a 17-person firm. Again, still with an emphasis on sitting CFO work. We'll do 60 to 70 projects a year, I would say. Half of those, a little more than half of those, are sitting CFO projects, with the balance really being split among CEO projects for small mid-cap companies primarily, and a fair amount of finance number twos, direct reports to the CFO. And then we also do a couple dozen board searches on top of that number. So it's really a high-level boutique that is industry agnostic, serves a lot of public companies, but as private equity money has poured into the market, those portfolio companies have come onto our screen as well.
Great, great. So you joined the firm. I guess you used to work for Rand McNally, the map company. Is that correct?
That's where I got my career start out of college. Kind of happy to be employed, saving money to get married, actually kind of fell into executive search. I was about a year and a half out of school, working at Rand McNally as an editor on their software products. When I got a strange call from Peter Crist, strange in that I never knew Peter, and strange in that I never really thought of executive search, honestly. But it was a stroke of luck that my boss's boss at the time at Rand McNally had offered my name to Peter as someone who could gather information from the internet, which was just becoming more and more important to executive search. And he took the time to call me, cold call me, and invite me in for a discussion. At the time, he had launched his boutique after 18 years with Russell Reynolds, and I took the call really on a whim. And I would say it was very serendipitous in that we've now been together for 20 years. So that was my entry. I kind of fell into it.
So Crist Colder publishes an annual volatility report. What is it exactly? How long has it been published? What can you tell me about that and introducing it?
Yeah, so when we launched the firm back in 2003, as I mentioned, there were three of us at the time. One thing we realized is that in our space, in executive search, and at the time a CFO boutique, there was always this sense of appearing to be thought leaders in your industry, giving the appearance that you're bigger than just at the time three people, and so Peter had an idea of looking into the rate of change at the C-levels of corporate America, and we realized we needed to crystallize what that meant, and so we decided that we would track the changes at the CEO, COO, and CFO chairs of a combination of companies made up of the S&P 500 list for that year and the Fortune 500 list that year. And when you combine those lists, you get roughly 650-660 unique companies. So in 2004, we issued our first volatility report, which, you know, as I look back at that, looks pretty rudimentary because I was doing it with, you know, along with our first two interns. We've had two interns every year since who work on this, and it has just become a much more impressive document today. We've issued it every single year. There are things we look into annually, year after year, but every year the interns that we hire are tasked with creating something unique and looking into other elements that would be interesting to the reader. So, yeah, it certainly serves its purpose. Though, you know, again, we're 17 people today, so we've grown as a firm, but it keeps us attuned to the marketplace that we're in every day, which is C-level America, and just the churn that, quite honestly, creates a marketplace for a firm like ours. So it's been a great run, and it's always well received, and it always turns out some interesting information.
So you've seen turnover in the C-suite reach an all-time high in the survey. Why is that happening?
Yeah, obviously, I think the answer is complex. But if I boil it down to more simplistic, why is this happening? I think if you ask someone, what do you think keeps a CEO up at night? The typical answer is, do I have the right people? And so if you say the most important asset to any company is its people, it's also in some ways the most inefficient, because unlike computers or unlike sales processes or systems, human beings have emotion, have egos. That asset becomes very inefficient if it doesn't feel utilized or starts to feel bored. So change comes about because this most important asset is also incredibly inefficient at times. And I've always thought that's why executive search exists, because this very critical yet inefficient asset moves around the market. And I think the all-time high and the nature of that is in part driven by individuals who are sitting on record increases in the stock market and equity valuations that are at an all-time high, and starting to consider their options. I do think that's part of what plays into the fact that this churn it will always continue. As long as I'm living, it will always continue, but it just seems to have been ratcheted up recently.
So it's not necessarily that the CFOs or other people in the C-suite aren't doing a good job. It may be more that they're seeing an out. I guess in a previous conversation, you used the phrase cashing out.
Yeah, to a certain extent. If you face the fact that every search that we're retained on certainly isn't because somebody's failing. It's all kinds of reasons: retirement, somebody got recruited out to another situation. And just to point out, while the rate is at an all-time high, it's not alarming. It's fluctuated for the CFO chair in that roughly 15% average when you look back over time. And in the 10 to 15% average for the CEO chair. So, it's up and down, but it's not as though it's all of a sudden hockey sticked into, some bizarre percentage of change. But yeah, to your point on cashing out, I do think that to a certain degree, people have taken their money off the table as the stock market has gone to all-time highs. And public companies use equity as a way to keep and retain their talent, but on the flip side of that, individuals view that as are we reaching a point where we're not going to be able to drive this much higher, and they become receptive to doing other things. And I will also say, for public companies, which is what we're tracking, the lure into private equity is large. There is just a ton of private money being put to use out there, and that while it's a higher risk scenario for individuals, it also creates a much higher reward, very different from public companies. I was in a conversation earlier today with a finalist on a search we're, the CFO search we're doing for a private equity owned company. His whole life has been in large public companies. And he brought this up. He said, if I stay in the public companies, I know what plays into my compensation plan. I know what elements will exist there. But the chance to hit the grand slam versus the home run, that exists in the private equity space, which is why we've seen, you know, quite a drain on public company talent into that space.
That's a good point. On that topic, I guess, you know, in your bio, it says that you kind of focus more on leading searches for CFOs and chief operating officers and corporate board members for your clients. How has that CFO search kind of landscape maybe changed over the years?
The most interesting change I've seen is just the pace. And what I mean by that is the request for immediate candidate introductions by clients. I think because there's so much information out there, I think it's created this sense that, you know, we can launch today and meet candidates tomorrow. And I hear it all the time from the candidate population that just the volume of inbound overtures has just become, you know, it could become a distraction if the individual lets all of that into their life. But, you know, I would say, you know, risk aversion has gone up over time. There are more touch points in these processes. I would say, at least specific to the CFO role, the level of board interaction in the process, not always just a blessing at the end. Does a candidate meet the chairman and of the audit committee and maybe a couple of other board members, but the fact that the board's kept abreast of the process to a much deeper degree, the number of touch points that candidates have to go through. And I will also point to the rise of the use of industrial psychology. It's almost every engagement we have, there is some use of industrial psychology as a point in the process, and it's varying degrees. It's everything from, you know, an online Hogan assessment to kind of test personality to we've had full day role playing immersion industrial psychology as part of a process where the finalist candidate had to with actors entering the room had to handle fire drills and you know what would come the way for a typical day as the CFO or CEO of a company. So it's clearly evolved over time, and I would say a lot of it's driven by the idea of mitigating risk, not making a bad pick.
So is that idea of not making a bad pick, is that kind of reflective maybe of board involvement in CFO searches changing over the years?
Well, you know, years ago you would, first of all, years ago, the CEO would choose the search firm partner and you'd kind of get going. Boards get involved in those decisions. So even who's going to be the partner on the engagement, we see board involvement. As I mentioned, years ago, you may get, a half an hour phone call with the chair of audit committee for the finalist, just because the finalist in a CFO search would like to know who that audit committee chairman is. Nowadays, you get a much deeper level of interaction from board members. So I think boards are just overall more focused on mitigating risk. A board member of a public company is, to a certain extent, a risky endeavor, and I think where there's knowledge, there's less risk, and so boards want to be more knowledgeable.
It makes sense. Makes sense. Let's delve into some something from the most recent report. What would you say are some key takeaways to you from that most recent one, which I guess came out last month in August, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, and it'll be updated over the December timeframe. So what we'll do in January is issue a full calendar year 18 report. So some of the key takeaways I would point to is one of the trends that way back in 2004 we saw continues to this day. So I don't know that this is something new, but the fact that the chief operating officer chair continues to decrease in numbers, it's just been a steady decline. That my conclusion on this is investors, boards have wanted over time for the CEO to be less of an external facing type of endeavor and more of a hands on the operations endeavor. But if you look at the trend, it's been a almost 15% decline in the last 10 years in terms of the numbers of these companies we track that have a COO in place. I also think part of what plays into this, quite honestly, is the evolution of the CFO chair from, really a debits and credits accounting control orientation to a business partner, which has become a bit of a cliche term. But I think everybody understands what that means, having a CFO who truly understands how the business operates and can act in the capacity of a business partner to the CEO. And with those two changes, I think the COO chair and the requirement for it in certain companies has been squeezed out.
Any other takeaways besides the COO role that you'd like to add?
Yeah, no, I think the fact that the CFO to CEO transition had increased in 2018. I think that's interesting for anybody who aspires to be a CFO. I know all the time I have conversations with CFOs when we talk just openly about their career. What path do you want to follow? I always ask the question, do you want to run something? Is being the CEO of something in your interests? And more often than not, the response is, I think that'd be interesting. So I found it interesting that that there was an increase. Certainly since 2012, there's been an increase in the number of CFOs who've gone on to be CEOs. And from last year to this year, there was also an increase. So I found that interesting. I also found interesting that less than 20% of sitting CFOs in the companies that we study have prior CFO experience at another company. That's interesting to me because I can't say 100% of our clients, but certainly close to that. When we are retained on a CFO search, there seems to always be the request of, we want a sitting CFO. That's what we want to look at. Candidates who have been CFOs before versus a strong number two, somebody who's on the cusp of being the sitting CFO. Yet, less than 20% of sitting CFOs have prior experience as a CFO at another company. So I found that interesting because there's only so much market for CFO talent. And if you're a small or mid-cap company, going to smaller companies for sitting CFOs, that's a very different experience in that individual than if you go to a much larger company for a number two who's ready to step in the chair, but maybe they're blocked. So I found that data point interesting. And then finally, certainly not the last interesting point in our document here, but the fact that the count of female CFOs is reaching an all-time high, and in both the CEO and CFO position, ethnic diversity is an all-time high. For one, I was pleased to see that. There's just a lot of talent out there in the female and diversity categories, and it's good to see that that these companies that we study are recognizing that and putting an effort behind recruiting it.
Does that say to you that companies have just kind of rethought the candidate pool they're looking at?
I think when it comes to diversity statistics, yes, there's been progress, but it's admittedly very slow. Part of what I was trying to kind of correlate why so slow. Part of it comes to when you look at where we study the schools that CFOs and CEOs come from, undergraduate schools. and you look at the data for some of these schools, as an example, Michigan, which I think was the top of the list for undergraduates for CEOs, you know, it was by at least one website, collegefactoid.com, was ranked, you know, 1,000, just over 1,000 in terms of diversity, ethnic diversity, and it's still 61% white. You know, Indiana, which was the number one school for CFOs, is 71% white. So part of it is the depth of the pool of talent, but I do think there has been more of a focus on requiring, and we've always, in our firm, always required the fact that when you see that first slate, it will include diversity. We put that right in our confirming letters. But I think clients are more attuned, companies are just more attuned to that requirement has to be part of the process. It just has to be. Diversity of thought is valuable, and companies, I think, are just more attuned to that for good reason.
Those are good points, Scott, and we will come back to the topic of colleges and universities that are regularly producing C-level talent. On another topic, Sandy Cockrell, who heads Deloitte's CFO program, said CFOs are having to retrain themselves on the technology that's available to the finance function. Are you seeing that trend playing a role in searches?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think CFOs are finance people. They're accounting and finance people, obviously, by training. Yet what they do is so dependent on the technology backbone that they're working on. So just the anecdotally, the number of requests we have for the candidate must have experience implementing ERP systems on a global scale, that sort of request just seems to be more prevalent today than maybe it was 10, 12, 15 years ago. You know, it really gets down to, you know, how does the CFO do finance faster, more efficiently, while maintaining accuracy? And a CFO who's knowledgeable of technology and can work very closely with the chief technology or chief information officer to make sure that the right systems and processes are in place, I think that's critical. Technology is at the core of what any company's doing, whether you're producing energy or in mining or manufacturing, or you're a high tech company out on the West Coast. The backbone of what finance does is data, and the data has to be useful. And a lot of what goes into that is just having a fundamental understanding of the right technology to get your job done.
So what about other skills beyond technology? How maybe has the toolkit for the CFO role changed or become more in demand these days?
I would say CFOs are asked to be the almost the chief strategist, and I mentioned before business partnering. It's no longer make sure the general ledger is accurate and everybody sleeps well at night and the SEC files are on time and accurate and everybody sleeps well at night. The CFO is at the table to talk about the business. Where are we? Where are we going? And the best talent in the CFO space wants that chair. Nobody is asking us anymore for I've kind of viewed it this way. The requirement for a CPA, it's always viewed as a positive. We get equal requests for folks who come up the investment banking route from an early stage. So public accounting is still at the top of the list of great training. But that person who started in public accounting and maybe moved into controllership, they must have the ability to become a thought partner with the CEO. The CEOs, our clients, are looking for a partner. And that term is used all the time. I need to find my partner to help me figure out where we're going with this business. And that's the biggest change. And again, that's created this vacuum for COOs out there, people who are focused on just operations, because I think the CFO, when you take a COO out, nature abhors a vacuum. I think you've seen the CFO become almost that quasi CFO, COO. You better understand the business, how we make money, how we go to market, et cetera, just as well as you make sure that the numbers are tied up at the end of the quarter.
So I noticed that international universities have the most sitting CEOs and the second most current CFOs. Do you have any details on what some of those international institutions are that are producing that talent, and what does that stat mean to you?
It's almost 13% of the current CEOs of these. It ended up being 651 of the 679 companies that we study, because several of the individuals, we could not find their educational background, so we didn't count that in the data. So 651 CEOs of Fortune 500 and S&P 500 companies, 13% of them have an international degree. I think it just speaks to the global nature of business. the talent comes from all over the place nowadays. What we do is a global effort. We are recruiting from all points of the globe. So I think it just speaks to that and nothing more. It certainly doesn't speak to any sort of failure of the U.S. educational system, because it is a small percentage in the grand scheme of things.
It does probably, go in hand in hand with that trend, just to be willing to look at a deeper pool. It's kind of tied into the diversity numbers, I believe.
It is. No, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And again, I wish, and maybe it's next year's study, that international number gets broken down more, just to see, if 40% of that is, Western Europe, it's not as interesting as if 10% of it is. So, unfortunately, I just don't have a bigger breakdown on the international number.
For the U.S. sports fans out there in particular, I guess, everyone likes to compare the college conferences, the groupings such as the Big Ten, the SEC, or the ACC. Who are some of the statistical leaders in that in the conference realm in the volatility report?
Well, I mean, the Big Ten. The Big Ten wins in both, which is interesting for, we've got some Big Ten graduates in our firm, and this is always a fun one to go through. And from the U.S. standpoint, both CFOs and CEOs, the Big Ten Conference is the winner. So, I don't know what that speaks to exactly. I will say the Big Ten, they have some terrific business schools that are always, near the tops of the ranks of business schools. So, obviously, they're turning out good talent.
Yeah, and everyone knows about the schools that produce talent year after year for the, the NFL or the NBA. Is there a school that could be like the Alabama of producing C-suite talent?
Yeah, it's a great question. As I looked at our full list here, within the top six for both chairs, CFO and CEO, there were four schools that appeared on both, and that's Penn, Harvard, Michigan and Stanford. So I would say, maybe there's not an Alabama out there that's, winning every year and producing incredible talent every year, but those four schools are doing something right, because they're within the ranks of CEOs and CFOs. They appear on both of those lists.
Scott, thank you. Last question. What's your advice for the listener who has the goal of becoming a CFO one day?
Yeah, the advice is breadth of experience. My analogy here is every investing mind out there will say the best strategy is to diversify. That holds true for your investments, and it holds true for the individual whose goal is to be a CFO. If you're a 12-year public accounting individual who wants to be a CFO, it's time to move into the corporate side, and maybe your entry point is as the assistant controller or corporate controller of a company. But you got to look for a platform that's going to allow you to branch out from there. You got to get out into the business as a divisional CFO. You have to crystallize and improve your financial planning and analysis skills. You have to be exposed to the balance sheet through treasury experience. It really is, Neil, the breadth of experience that produces the best CFO and you know, produces the best thought partner for a CEO. That really is the most important advice I can give someone who has that goal of becoming a sitting CFO.
Scott, thank you so much for your time and insights today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Neil. All interesting topics, and there's lots of good information that comes out of this report every year, so I always enjoy talking about it.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.